In their controversial bestseller, Forbidden Archaeology, Michael Cremo and Richard Thompson documented evidence showing that humans have existed on Earth for hundreds of millions of years. Such anomalous evidence, contradicting Darwinian evolution, well, started all kinds of inquiries. If we did not evolve from apes, then where did we come from? Now, human evolution is Michael Cremo's definitive answer to that question. We did not evolve up from matter. Instead, he says, we devolved or came down from the realm of pure consciousness, spirit. In a moment, Michael Cremo on Coast to Coast AM. Michael Cremo is a member of the History of Science Society, the World Archaeological Congress, the Philosophy of Science Association, the European Association of Archaeologists, and a research associate in history and philosophy of science for the, boy, how do I pronounce this, Bhaktivedanta Institute. We'll see if I got close to that. After receiving a scholarship to study international affairs at George Washington University, Michael began to study the ancient histories of India, known as the Vedas. In this way, he has broadened his academic knowledge with the spirituality from the Eastern tradition. And Michael is on the cutting edge of science and cultural issues. In the course of a few months' time, he might be found on a pilgrimage to sacred sites in India, appearing on a national television show in the United States or another country, lecturing at a mainstream science conference, or speaking to an alternative science gathering. As he crosses disciplinary and cultural boundaries, he presents to his various audiences a compelling case for negotiating a new consensus on the nature of reality, and he's back on Coast to Coast AM. Hi, Michael. How are you?
I'm fine, George. How are you?
Good, good. Now, how close did I come to pronouncing that right?
Pretty close. Bhaktivedanta Institute.
Bhaktivedanta. Okay, I'll just have you pronounce it from here on in. What have you been doing since we last talked? You've been busy, haven't you?
Well, you know, there's more and more interest than what I've been saying around the world. I'm just continually traveling. Over the past few months, I've been to the United Kingdom. I've been to Estonia, a little country, and a little country on the Baltic Sea.
Mm-hmm.
Used to be part of the Soviet Union. I really like those people there. They're a very small country, only about 1.5 million people, but they stood up for what they believed was right, and they freed themselves from the Soviet Union in, 10 or 12 years ago. So I like them. And then over the next few months, I'll be going to speak at a few scientific conferences in Europe and in China, and be going later on this year on a 6-week tour of Brazil, where my book, The Hidden History of the Human Race, has been published. So there's been a lot happening in all these areas.
You know, when we first talked, which was back during my days in St. Louis, I was just awestruck with that first book of yours and Richard Thompson's, Forbidden Archaeology. I mean, the depth of the work that you two put into it was one thing, which was magnificent, but the theories, and just it is just so compelling and thought-provoking. I just couldn't put it down. And I mean, that I think, Michael, your theories might be one of the reasons why it continues to drive me to try to search out who we are. There isn't an interview that I have with someone when we're talking about ancient archaeology that I don't quote you or say something about what you've done, because of the fact that I, too, believe that human beings have been around way longer than scientists are telling us.
Well, George, I think we're all, you know, doing our part in this. There's some of us who are doing the research and the writing. There's some of us who are doing these fantastic radio shows and television shows, and there are people who are doing other kinds of work, just learning about this, telling their friends about it. I think one of the great benefits I've had personally of going on shows like yours is having the people call in or write to me after having heard me on your show or some of the other alternative science radio shows, and give me really hard new information that's going to be helpful in putting together a new book that I'm working on now. I'm calling it Forbidden Archaeology 2, which will be more evidence for extreme human antiquity.
Let's talk a little bit about evolution and then devolution. First of all, evolution, we all generally have a pretty good idea of what that is, though we might not agree with it. The new theory here in the new book, of course, Human Devolution. Tell me about that.
Well, what I'm proposing there is, to put it very simply, is that we didn't evolve up from matter. Rather, we've devolved or come down from a level of the cosmos dominated by pure consciousness or spirit, if somebody likes that word. And what I started out to say was that before we even asked the question, where did human beings come from, we should first of all ask the question, what is a human being? Because today, many scientists are going to say, well, a human being is just a combination of chemicals, a combination of the ordinary material elements. And that kind of limits the kinds of explanations that you can give. You're simply limited to explaining, well, how did the atoms combine together? But I think when we look at all the evidence that comes to us from various fields of scientific investigation, we're going to see that it's more reasonable to say that a human being is a combination of three things. Ordinary matter, yes, that's part of what a human being is. But beyond that, there's a subtle mind element, and beyond that, there's the element of consciousness. And when I speak of mind and consciousness as elements, I don't mean temporary byproducts of bioelectrical activity right. going on in the brain. I mean that mind is an element, consciousness is an element, just as much as gold and silver are elements. Now, they may be a little more subtle, but they're nevertheless real elements, not simply temporary byproducts of activity going on in the brain. And there's a whole body of scientific evidence that supports that. Now, just as in the case of the archaeological evidence that I talk about in the book Forbidden Archaeology, there's been a lot of what I call knowledge filtration going on. There's a lot of evidence that scientists have collected about these topics that really doesn't get the attention it deserves. So that when many people hear, well, matter, mind, and consciousness, or body, mind, spirit, or something like that, they think, well, that's just sort of some New Age jargon, but that's because they're not really aware of the scientific evidence that backs up these claims.
And you know what? They've probably never even wanted to investigate when they hear these things.
Well, you know, I don't know about that, George, because I think people are very interested in these things, but they turn to the wrong authorities, really, for their answers. They're accustomed to get the answers to their questions about these things from the people that are now dominant in the education system and in the scientific world. But I think the growth of radio programs like yours shows that a lot of people are starting to understand that you've got to turn to some alternative sources of knowledge if you're really going to get close to the truth, and that, you know, you're not necessarily going to get the whole truth from your science textbook in your high school or college classroom, or, you know, by listening to the sorts of scientists you're going to see on PBS or things like that. I think a lot of people are interested in these things. That's what I find all over the world. People all over the world are very interested.
What about mainstream science, though? Are they interested when they hear this, or do they scoff at you?
Well, you know, even the world of mainstream science is changing. It's not as monolithic as it used to be. For example, I was recently invited to give a special talk at the annual meeting of the Society for the Anthropology of Consciousness, which is a division of the American Association of Anthropologists. And so it's a mainstream scientific organization. But still, they were interested to hear what I had to say about these topics, because consciousness is something that this particular group of scientists, anthropologists, are interested in. And I went over some of the evidence with them, and they found it really quite interesting. Of course, many of them are also interested in these same kinds of evidence, but you know, the tendency has been to dismiss it. But still, I think if ideas are going to change, the very first thing is that scientists have to be willing to listen to listen to alternatives. And I think many in the scientific world are interested. I've had a lot of experience myself in that. For example, a couple of years ago, I was invited to give a talk at the Department of Nuclear Physics of the main science university in Budapest in Hungary. Mm-hmm. And the audience was about 100 professors of physics and graduate students of physics. So I went through some of this evidence for the mind element. For example, I told them about the case of Marie and Pierre Curie, who are two of the most famous physicists in the world. You know, they were husband and wife. They both got Nobel Prizes in physics for their work in discovering radium. Mm-hmm. And you read about that in every physics textbook. What you don't read in the physics textbook is that they were heavily involved in psychical research. You know, they were doing experiments with mediums, people with psychokinetic abilities, and actually the Curies were part of a group of about 20 prominent European scientists who were doing this kind of research in Paris early in the 20th century. And this whole group, which included 5 Nobel Prize winners, including the Curies, did 2 years of research with a medium named Eusebia Palladino, she was from Italy. And these experiments took place in the Psychology Institute in Paris. And on one occasion, you know, Marie Curie was there controlling the medium, and other scientists were also there. And in the middle of the laboratory, in broad daylight, under carefully controlled experimental conditions, Pierre Curie, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, said that a large table was floating right in the middle of the room. And this wasn't like one of these scenes that, you know, you often see when people want to talk about this stuff in a derogatory way,
right,
like in some dark living room and who knows what's going on. This was an actual scientific experiment that took place in a scientific institution in Paris with some of the top experimental scientists in the world carefully controlling all the factors. And under those conditions, this woman was able to produce these macro psychokinetic effects. And I mean, to me, it's evidence for a mind element that can act on ordinary matter in ways that we really can't explain, you know, by our current laws of physics. So I went through a lot of these cases, and at the end I was wondering, what are these physicists going to say?
And cool. And what was the look on their faces while you were speaking to them?
Well, you know, as I said, it's these, even in the world of mainstream science, it's not monolithic. You've got some people who are going to be very dismissive of this sort of thing, you know, your psychop sort of people. And for the listeners who don't know what psychop is, that's a society of skeptics that wants to, you know, just dismiss everything that goes against, you know, their particular way of looking at things. So you've got that kind of person there. But you also have other kinds of people in the world of science who have more open minds, and at least they're willing to give serious consideration to things like this. So one of the professors of physics walked up to me after the talk and said, you know, I'm very glad you gave this talk, because by day I'm doing plasma physics. You know, that's the physics of superheated gases. And he said, but But privately, at night, I'm doing experiments in telepathy. And he told, and he told me, I put my little son in another room, and I flip a coin, and you know, he's got to guess, you know, what it is, heads or tails. And he told me his son was getting over 80% correct.
Oh, that's way beyond probability.
Way beyond probability. So, you know, he asked me to put him in touch with some psychical researchers, which I agreed to do. But he told me I wouldn't speak about this to my colleagues, because many of them would think I'd gone off the deep end. So that's something I encounter quite a bit as I, you know, travel around the world, that there are scientists who are part of the mainstream and who may, by day, you might say, you know, appear quite orthodox in their activities and thoughts, but who really are harboring some really interesting ideas. And I mean, just another thought along that line. A couple of years ago, I was invited to speak at the geology department of a major university here in the United States.
So you do get a lot of heavyweight assignments to speak at some pretty good universities.
Well, and not only universities, but some of the top scientific institutions in the world. Over the past couple of years, I've been invited to speak at the Royal Institution in London, which is one of the top scientific organizations in England. It's been in existence for 300 years. You know, I've been invited to speak at the Russian Academy of Sciences in Moscow and other places, and I've also been able to present papers at major international conferences on archaeology, like the World Archaeological Congress, the meetings of the European Association of Archaeologists. So I think the world of even mainstream science is changing. There still is this very materialistic element there that's very dominant and has a lot of influence. But you've also got people with more open minds, a new generation of scientists, some of whom are willing to go a little bit further than their predecessors have gone.
Well, you know, Michael, for us to talk about the human devolution, you have to talk about your work in forbidden archaeology, of your thoughts and theories that humans are millions of years old. When did you, and we may have to hold this until we come back from the break, but think about this. What was it that dawned on you that made you decide or think, hey, there's something very different going on here? Human beings are not hundreds of thousands of years old or in civilizations of 10,000 years old. They have gone back millions of years. Was it the artifacts that you were uncovering and finding, or was it something else?
Well, it wasn't that I was uncovering artifacts that made me start thinking about that. What made me start thinking about this is when I started traveling around the world and investigating the ancient writings of various civilizations. And one of the set of writings I was very interested in was the Vedas, the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. And among those writings, there's a group called the Puranas, or the histories. And I found they spoke of human civilizations that have existed on this planet since the very beginning of the history of life on Earth, going back hundreds of millions of years.
All right, hold that thought right there, Michael, because when we come back, I want to pick up from the Vedas, because this is a startling discussion of what life could have been like, as you say, hundreds of millions of years ago. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment with Michael Cremo. His website and related websites you can find on coasttocoastam.com, right under his name. Our guest tonight on Coast to Coast is Michael Cremo. Michael, let's get back to the Vedas and some of the theories of the very, very ancient human existence on this planet.
Well, you're asking what got me started on this forbidden archaeology research. And it was my, you know, encounter with these ancient Sanskrit writings of India, which are collectively called Vedas. Veda is a Sanskrit word. It means knowledge. And among the ancient Sanskrit writings is a group called the Puranas, or the Histories, and they tell of human civilizations that existed millions of years ago. They tell us that humans have been on Earth since the very beginning of the history of the Earth, really. So I found that really quite amazing. And then when I began to look at the writings of other ancient civilizations, I found that they were saying pretty much the same thing, whether you look at the Egyptian writings or ancient Chinese writings or listen to what the ancient Australian Aboriginal account of the history of life on Earth is, or the great civilizations of the Americas, like the Mayans and the Incas and the Aztecs and the Pacific Islanders, the Native American peoples in North America. You look at the Bible, they're all saying pretty much the same thing, namely that humans have been around since the beginning of the history of life on Earth. So until I started looking at what these ancient writings are telling us, I didn't, and take it seriously, I really didn't have any reason to question the accounts of human origins that I learned in high school and at the university. I really didn't have any reason to question it. But when I saw what practically all of these ancient people were saying was the same, that humans had been around since the beginning, that's when I really started to look into the question, is there any physical evidence to support what these ancient writings are saying, or is it just mythology?
If one civilization, one group had mentioned it and none of the others had, would you have just passed over it, do you think?
Well, I don't know. What happened was I found they're all saying the same thing.
Exactly.
So I don't know if I can put myself, you know, back in the situation where I was 30, 35 years ago and tell you what I would have done if it had been different. I mean, what I can tell you is that they all do say the same thing, and that impressed me.
That was remarkable all by itself.
Yeah, that was pretty remarkable. And then what I also found was remarkable is when I started to look into current scientific literature to see if there was anything I missed and didn't see any evidence at all to support that, well, I thought, well, let me just look a little bit deeper. Let me just go beyond what's in these textbooks, and let me go back to the original scientific reports. Because what you get in a textbook is not the original scientific reports. What you get in a textbook is
an interpretation.
You know, somebody has selected what to put in that textbook. So I thought, well, let me go back to the original scientific reports of the past 150 years in all different languages. So that's what I started to do. Because somehow or other, in my education, I acquired a reading knowledge of most of the European languages, you know, Russian, German, Italian, French, Spanish. So I began looking into them. I looked at the scientific reports, and what I found was pretty amazing. I found that over the past 150 years, there have been hundreds of discoveries of human bones, human artifacts, and human footprints, showing that humans like us had been around for millions and millions and millions of years, going all the way back to the very beginning of the history of life on Earth.
I'll remember the two things you told me years ago, Michael, that just continue to stay in my mind. That was the human footprints by the dinosaur prints, and then those steel balls that they found way down within the planet.
Well, those would be the spherical objects found by miners in South Africa, and they're made of a kind of iron called hematite, not steel, but it's nevertheless a type of iron. And the most amazing feature is the parallel grooves that go around the center of each object. Some of them have two, some of them have three, some of them have four, and metallurgists who examined these said they couldn't explain how they could have formed naturally within the layers of the Earth, you know, especially with, you know, the grooves going around them. And to me, that indicates that they had to have been made by someone with human-like intelligence, but they're found in a mine in South Africa near a place called Ootstalen in the western Transvaal region. And they're found in mineral deposits over 2 billion years old. And as far as the footprints go, there have been a lot of discoveries of footprints. The ones that you mention of footprints being found alongside the footprints of dinosaurs come from Glen Rose, Texas. And I didn't even mention those. I may have spoken about them to you on the radio show, but I didn't put them in Forbidden Archaeology, in the book Forbidden Archaeology, because at that time when I was doing the research for the book, I still had some questions about them, and I only wanted to put into the book things that I was very, very sure of, that I could document very well. And those footprints were originally reported by a Christian creationist scientist, Dr. Henry Morris, Jr., and he later withdrew his claims about them in a letter that he wrote to Nature, which is one of the big, you know, scientific publications.
Sure.
So I was thinking that, well, because the person who originally reported them has now withdrawn his claims, that raised some doubts in my own mind about those particular discoveries. But later on, there was, and this often happens, sometimes people get in touch with me. So an archaeology student from Texas wrote to me and asked if there was anything she could do to help out with my work. So I said, well, what I'd like you to do is go up to Glen Rose, Texas, to Paluxy River, and have a look at those footprints. So she went up there, and she met some of the investigators that were working up there, and she participated in some new excavations, and she gave me a very thorough report, including photographs, her own personal observations, and reports by other investigators that convinced me that they really do have a very good case there of human footprints and layers of rock about 100 million years old. In those same layers, you can also find, you know, footprints of dinosaurs. But things like this happen a lot. I mean, people do get in touch with me, and they do give me, you know, important new pieces of information. I think one of your listeners just the other day sent me a very interesting report that I'd never heard of before. This a man named George McConnell up in Oregon. Yeah, he sent me this very interesting report from a newspaper published in Oregon in the year 1904. And it tells of some miners near a place called Waldo up there who were digging down, and about 60 feet below the surface, they found some stone mortars and pestles, which are human artifacts, in this heavily cemented gravel. In other words, it wasn't found in some loose deposits. This was found 50 or 60 feet deep, solidly embedded in a solidified conglomerate, you know, where you have gravel and sand and things like that that have hardened to the consistency of cement, basically. And the geological reports that this gentleman referred me to say that these deposits where these objects were found go back to what's called, in geological terms, the Tertiary period, which starts about 2 million years ago and goes back many million years further than that. So these objects then would be at least 2 million years old from right here in America. And according to the current theories that you find in every textbook today, you don't have humans present in the Americas until 20,000 years ago maximum. And here you've got, you know, this very interesting report of human artifacts in America 2 million years old.
And one of the things that I find remarkable about the work you've done, Michael, is that some of the ancient civilizations and the ones that are millions and millions of years old, the technology was better than what we have today.
Well, you can find some indications like that in the documents that these ancient civilizations have left. Now, as far as some of the archaeological discoveries, they may appear a little bit primitive, but I think there are ancient technological remains that could be found. But I think one problem is that not very many people are looking for them in a very, very serious way. But, you know, say the ancient Sanskrit writings, for example, speak of spaceships existing millions of years ago. They speak of weapons resembling our modern atomic weapons. They speak of people being able to calculate time according to the movements of atoms. These ancient Sanskrit writings contain descriptions of observations of the human egg, which in Western science they didn't understand until they invented the microscope back in, you know, the 1600s. So thousands and millions of years ago, I think there were technically advanced civilizations who had abilities that were now just starting to recover. But I think the reason for that is that things go in cycles.
Michael, did you ever come across any information, any evidence that would have proven some of these theories, some of these writings, that there might have been some kind of horrible nuclear catastrophe that might have occurred between some of these ancient civilizations?
Well, of course, in the Bible, they have the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, which, if you look at it pretty carefully, resembles a description of a nuclear attack. The ancient Sanskrit writings of India definitely describe the use of weapons resembling nuclear weapons in warfare. They were called Brahmastras, technically. So you do find reports here and there. You know, for example, once, and this report is pretty common on the internet. You can find it in a lot of different places. That at a place called Kurukshetra in India, where one of these battles took place, there's a report that some scientists found an area of vitrified sand, which means sand that's turned to glass, which is what you see at Alamogordo in, you know, New Mexico, where the first American bomb was tested. So, but when I looked more carefully into that report, I wasn't able to track down any of the scientists that were mentioned, and I wasn't able to track down any exact detailed information about the exact location of the area of sand that had turned to glass. So sometimes you find that in some of these reports that they're very interesting. But sometimes when you dig a little bit deeper, you're not able to actually verify, you know, the information in these reports. So even as an alternative science researcher myself, I'm inclined, you know, to accept these things, and I believe they're true. But I find if I'm going to present information to people in a credible way, sometimes I need a little bit more than you get in some of these reports.
Well, that's true.
There are a couple of ways to learn about the past. One way is to dig into the earth and look for what you can find there. Now, that's there you've got certain limitations because geologists tell us that over 95% of the sedimentary layers that have ever been laid down on Earth have been worn away by different kinds of erosion. So that means, say if we want to look at the layers of the Earth as a big book, say 1,000 pages long, 950 pages are gone, you know, of the book.
Yeah.
So one problem is that it's not a complete record. So, but I think what is there is very significant. I think there are indications of advanced technological civilizations, but I think there's more evidence to be found. But what we need is a new generation of researchers who are prepared to go out there and look for it and find it.
Is it possible that some of this evidence could be buried thousands of feet underground for some reason?
In some places, that could happen. For example, you go to the Grand Canyon, you've got, several thousand feet of deposits. Now, in some places, the very ancient deposits are at the surface, and in some places, they're very far down under the surface. So in each particular place, you have to take into account what the geological situation is.
Michael, when we come back, because we're approaching the top of the hour, let's find out then how you tie in the human devolution with the physical finding of man and how you talk about that we didn't evolve from matter, but primarily the consciousness and spirit. Did that include then some kind of divine intervention, in your opinion?
Well, I think people are looking for pretty simple explanations in a lot of cases. These days, I think you've got three main explanations for human origins. One is divine intervention. The other is a very simple evolution account. The chemicals combine together to form the first living thing, and they gradually turn into monkeys, ape men, and human beings. And then you've got the extraterrestrial, very simple extraterrestrial intervention ideas. And what I think is the case is things are a little more complicated than the supporters of those ideas can imagine, and that what we've really got is a very complex interaction between that includes some kind of divine intervention, some overall design and control by some kind of cosmic intelligence. You've also got an extraterrestrial aspect to it because I believe that life is present not just on Earth, but it's scattered throughout the universe and not just on one dimension, but on higher dimensions as well. And you've also got a kind of evolution going on that I call devolution. It's a very complex web.
And let's talk about that web when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM.